Welcome! My name is Melissa Takai, and thanks for tuning into Radioactive. Just in case you don't know, Radioactive is a program that allows youth to tell amazing stories here at KUOW Public Radio in Seattle. We also have a podcast, which is what you're listening to right now. And speaking of Seattle, this month's episode is all about this fast-growing city and its growing pains. Not too long ago, I talked to some Radioactivians in college about what changes they've noticed when they come back home. I was curious because I'm still in high school, so I haven't left the city that long enough to see what's different. Specifically, the large population of vegans and vegetarians here, which is what Radioactivian Jalen Wheeler pointed out to me. He was so curious about that he even visited Wallingford to learn more about one vegan restaurant's perspective on it.
I recently changed my diet. I stopped eating red meat and pork, and this made me more conscious. I have been having conversations with my friend who is vegan, and it has made me a lot more aware about what I put into my body. Seattle has become one of the forefront cities of this vegan and vegetarianism movement. Harvest Beat is a vegan and eco-friendly restaurant located in Wallingford. I talked to them about how Seattle's vegan and veggie population are changing. I walked into the restaurant and immediately smelled some kind of dessert cooking. The walls are made from a dark granite-like material, and lights are paved all across the ceiling.
Hey guys, how's it going? I'm Jalen.
Hey Jalen, I'm Jan.
Hi, how are you?
Aaron
here,
I'm great.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good to meet you.
Unlike most restaurants, Harvest Beat strives to
give people an experience. It represents local farming, organic food. We do vegan, so it's representing vitality food through an experience, which you enjoy the five courses and sit together. Being in community is part of Harvest Beat, the people we work with, but also the people we serve.
For those who don't know, being vegan means to not eat any animal products, whereas being vegetarian is to refrain from meat. Before Harvest Beat, there was Sutra, a small vegan store also located in Wallingford. Everything was going well until they found themselves in a tough situation.
When we first found out that Sutra was not going to be around any longer because our lease got pulled out from underneath us, we started Harvest Beat, and our first project was doing vegan food up at the Wallingford Farmers Market.
Oh,
yeah.
And it was great.
You guys loved it?
Loved it.
Yeah, and it's such great way to meet people. And then you realize there's not a lot of... Like, a lot of people do, like, a vegetarian, you know, like, but a lot of them have meat there and stuff, too. So we're the only ones that were doing just a straight-up, just vegetarian,
Sutra's original mission was to give high-quality, healthy, and fast food to the local people at Wallingford. This goal was shortly ended due to Seattle's raising prices for rent and leasing, which has become a common theme amongst many new restaurants in Seattle, trying to keep up with the high demand for money.
I was thinking the only thing that's hard about Seattle maybe for anybody is just being able to like come in, pay the rent, and be able to have a restaurant that's not a big, huge restaurant in a chain.
Raising prices has not stopped Harvest Beat from making high-quality food for the public. With the growing number of vegans and vegetarians, business is better than ever. We went deeper into understanding Seattle's vegan population.
So... in terms of trying to adapt to all of these new changes that we're going to have to make, do you think Seattle's doing, like, a decent job of trying to get vegan and vegetarian restaurants like yourself out?
Absolutely. Well, I mean, there could always be more.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we have got a great selection. I mean, if you want to find some good vegan food, whether it be breakfast, lunch, or dinner, you can. You absolutely can in Seattle. It's easy.
According to a poll from the Seattle Times, 41% of people feel as if Seattle is a veggie and vegan paradise. 38% feel that it's good but still needs improvement. And 20% feel that everything is better in Portland.
But I think it'd be great to see a little bit more options and probably for some people affordable options. Like ours is kind of an experience where you pay to come in. But I think even just that, like, the whole lunch thing, you know. Like in our neighborhood, we have a place across the street, but there's not a lot of vegetarian places around here.
When I ate at Harvest Beat, initially I was nervous because I never ate anything vegan in my life. However, it turned out being one of the best desserts I've had in a long time. And this made me think, With the growing amount of people that are adapting to these lifestyles, do we really have enough to accommodate everyone? For Radioactive, this is Jalen Wheeler.
Fun fact, according to the U.S. Census, population increase in Seattle is currently the 11th fastest in the country. Since a portion of those people could be vegan or vegetarian, hopefully Seattle can accommodate everyone's lifestyles, including me, because I could definitely go for some vegan food right now. Except I don't have any pocket change on me at the moment. Man, I wish I got a job this summer, especially since Seattle's new minimum wage is $15 an hour. But I hear from Radioactivian Aubrey Violetta Gilperin that the raise isn't as great as it seems. She talked to some friends on how the raise positively and negatively affects students looking for summer jobs.
Between paying off student debt, buying groceries, and participating in campus activities, college students are notoriously strapped for cash. The obvious solution is for students to get a job. The city of Seattle's minimum wage is currently $13 an hour, but is raising to $15 on January 1st, 2017. How does this change things for working students? I have held minimum wage jobs since I was 15, but even with 3 years of experience under my belt, getting a job this summer proved to be incredibly difficult. Employers either weren't hiring or didn't want to waste funds training a college student who would eventually quit when they returned to school in a few months.
Somebody at my current workplace just quit, and my boss told me they lost $300 training him, and he did not even contribute anything to them at all.
That was Fee Nguyen, a college sophomore who works just north of Seattle.
And then I would probably give her a kid's paddle.
It pays $11 an hour, which is becoming more common for jobs surrounding the city. Despite the state minimum wage being $9.32 an hour, many businesses just outside of Seattle have raised their wages to remain competitive in the $15 an hour market. Not everyone is lucky enough to even get a job. Nguyen said some of his friends struggled with the job rejection this summer.
You just really have to know somebody on the inside. The job I have currently, I had a recommendation from a friend.
For people who went away to school for a year and then returned home for summer, this is especially difficult. They simply don't have the same connections that people who live in Seattle year-round do. For Nguyen, increased wages also means more free time. Since he makes the same amount of money while working fewer hours, he finds more time to participate in clubs, play for sports teams, and intern. Nguyen says he was okay with making less than people who work inside Seattle city limits because of his job's proximity to his school, the University of Washington Bothell, and his home, though he hopes that as the Seattle campus increases its student worker wages, that the Bothell campus will follow suit. For some, the $15 an hour minimum wage in Seattle is too appealing to resist. Izzy Matlick commutes by bus to get from Kenmore to U Village, where she works at Jamba Juice.
During the summer, it's kind of inconvenient to work at U Village because it's like riding the bus adds probably 2 hours of commute to whatever time I work. So if I work like 9:30 to 2, I probably wake up at 7, 7:30.
Matlick thinks a lot of people have misconceptions regarding how college students spend their money. For her, the increased minimum wage means she'll have an easier time paying off her student loans.
One of the things that I do have to pay off or pay for is like student debt, and it's like really, really important to me to pay that off as soon as possible.
She applied to a few different places before she received her first job offer. Her $13 an hour wage also allows Matlick to attend local events. She says she's more likely to spend money if she makes more. So while she packs her own lunch and takes public transportation to work, occasionally she'll splurge at one of the U Village stores.
I still budget the same way I would if I made $9.40 an hour, you know, but I would say that I eat out more often and I go shopping for myself more often.
While some are relieved at having extra wages to help cover the rising cost of education, others are struggling to find temporary work at the minimum wage. Matlick admits that there's a lot of small, negative factors about the increased minimum wage in Seattle that often go overlooked.
Pollution and traffic and like all this other stuff. So I think there are a lot of things that people don't necessarily think about as factors that arise from the increase in minimum wage.
As Seattle works towards a $15 an hour minimum wage, students and youth in the area are observing both negative and positive aspects of the change. I guess we'll just have to wait and find out what the long-term effects of the $15 an hour minimum wage will be. For Radioactive, I'm Aubrey Violetta Gilperin.
I'm actually entering college next year, so Aubrey's story was really informative. I need to make sure I keep my costs down as a freshman, so finding a summer job won't be my biggest priority. However, I know I can't completely avoid college debt. So, hopefully the summer job market in Seattle becomes less competitive. Ugh, I wish I could talk to a city official about some issues, but Radioactivian Yafia Bezeba already did that. He attended a community focus group meeting that was open to the public to hear how the city plans to deal with its growth.
The city of Seattle anticipates that by the year 2035, we will have 120,000 more people, 70,000 more housing units, and 115,000 more jobs. Perhaps that is why we are experiencing what some could call growing pains.
We now get 0 3-bedroom units. We get a very small number of 2-bedroom units. They are not family friendly.
I've lived in the city for less than a year. They got rid of density limits for most of the city in 2010. I didn't know we had any.
And the other thing is the city says that they're trying to push to have family housing available.
These are still housing.
For, you know, families, more square footage in the units, yet they're creating incentive to have the opposite, just tiny, tiny micro units.
Since I was born in North Seattle 2 decades ago, I've witnessed the continuum of change. And now, with the Seattle 2035 Comprehensive Plan, the next 20 years are just around the corner. In this exclusive interview with Patrice Carroll, one of the leads on the project, we discuss the outline of the plan and its impact on community development, economic growth, and equity.
Seattle 2035 is the city's, what we call the city's comprehensive plan. It's comprehensive because it deals with a whole range of issues, land use, housing, transportation, but also some of the other things like arts and culture, community well-being. So it's really a place for us to pull together our vision for how we want the city to grow over the next 20 years. So where should that growth go? That's really the big question about the comprehensive plan. And our plan has always been based on something we call the urban village strategy. And again, to answer that question of where growth should go, and we think the smartest place for growth to happen in Seattle are in these places that we call urban villages. And these are places that you know well. It's downtown Seattle. It's the University District. It's Ballard. But it's also places like Lake City or Columbia City that are a little bit smaller, a little less dense. So we think it's smart for those places to grow because that's where people have access to shops and stores and transit. And particularly in this next 20 years, I think the biggest change is really trying to connect our land use and our transit. So that's been a big area that we've focused. And so we're thinking maybe we need to change some of the boundaries of those urban villages in order to make the most of the transit that we have now, to give more people opportunities to live near that very best transit that we do have. That, and the transit is super important. It gives them access to jobs throughout the region, really, and also other kinds of amenities that they might not have in their own neighborhood.
Seattle is in high demand, and growth is good for the local economy. The next 20 years will have a profound impact on the city that we become.
Another way that the comprehensive plan gets implemented is a whole series of what are referred to as neighborhood plans between 1995 and 2000, after we did our first comprehensive plan. And since that time, we've gone back and we've worked with some of those communities to update those plans, to reflect some of the newer challenges. And we're hearing that people are really interested in seeing those plans implemented. So not just having the plan on the shelf, but actually seeing change happen in their neighborhood. So I think that the community planning that we do moving forward is really going to be about trying to spend a lot more effort trying to coordinate city investments in specific neighborhoods.
The mayor and city planners are tasked with listening to the public, setting long-term goals, and balancing differing opinions for our future. If you have an opinion at all on this topic, make your voice be heard.
We always struggle with trying to get young people to get involved in these planning processes. So I'm really excited that you have been so interested in this. And hopefully people like you can help raise awareness among their peers, because it's so important to have the next generation participate and share their dreams and share their ideas, because this plan is really going to affect you a lot more than it will the older baby boomer generation. And we're trying to figure out new ways where we can reach out to broader audiences, because and not just young people, but really the full diversity, because we know that we as a nation, as a city, are going to become a lot more diverse in over the next 20 years as well. So that is going to really, we really have to push ourselves to think of new ways to make sure that we're getting all of the voices at the table.
I invite you to think about these questions. How connected do you feel to your community? Where should our priorities lie? What kind of place do we want Seattle to become? And do you feel involved in the citywide conversation about our future? For KUOW, this is Yafi Epizapa.
To be honest with you, I don't involve myself in any city planning, even though I really should be. Like Patrice Carroll said, we young people are going to be the most affected by the decisions that the city settles on. So please, get yourself out there and be heard. And if you can't, why don't you check us out on our website at kuow.org/radioactive. Radioactive strives to amplify the voices of young people, so please support us. You can also find us on Facebook at Radioactive Youth Media or on Twitter at KUOW Radioactive. Also, please subscribe to our podcast on iTunes if you haven't already. It'd be awesome if you could leave us a review there, because it helps us get noticed. And before I go, I want to thank Jenny Asarno, Angela Nguyen, and Fevin McConan for supporting us in the making of this episode. Okay, that's all, folks. Peace out.